And we're recording, go for it.
Sorry, Glenn has to finish his solo first, but hello and welcome once again to Lickman and Rizoff Live, in air quotes, at Grassroots Tavern. As always, I'm John Lickman, contributor for The House Next Door and damn handsome man.
I'm Vadim Rizov, victim of postgraduate malaise.
And of course, Keith Ulick, editor of The House Next Door, and still reading the same book.
Yes, hello. Just because I edit all the time, I have no time to read.
That's true. Join us today, we have two special guests. We have Glenn Kenny of Some Came Running, and formerly of a film website that has since gone downhill. And also Karina.
Same could be said for me, actually.
Let Glenn say hi.
I'm not allowed to discuss this under the terms of my non-disparagement clause. And in Keith's defense, let me just say that one needs to take time to really savor the prose of Christopher Isherwood.
This is true. This is true. And the other one?
And Karina Longworth of Spoutblog.
Hello.
So, of course, because Vadim and I were so busy not being able to afford going to con, or, you know,
sleeping drunk till noon every day for 2 weeks.
Right? Can I just point out that the song that's playing on the jukebox in the background is Led Zeppelin's Ramble On, in which Robert Plant actually references Gollum and the Evil One in a Lord of the Rings hat tip. Just...
which explains a lot about the way that, like, heavy metal and Lord of the Rings culture have dovetailed.
Absolutely.
Very true.
And speaking of low culture, the Cannes Film Festival. So, Glenn and Karina, you both were there. Now, I know you guys, you've said that you have similar taste on everything that was there.
We both liked a couple of less popular films.
Yes.
Okay, so.
Probably particularly Two Lovers and The Girl film.
Right. My own attitude towards Two Lovers is that I didn't dislike it as much as a lot of other people did.
And me too. I mean, I don't think it's a masterpiece, but I think that there's something really interesting about it.
I thought there was a certain... I liked the ambition of it. I liked the kind of quasi-hallucinatory romanticism of it. You know, I don't buy into the sort of automatic, knee-jerk reaction of a lot of my critics and friends who were sort of like, oh, Joaquin Phoenix is a Jew? That's ridiculous. I mean, that whole theme leads into opening a can of worms that you don't even want to go into.
Indeed.
But, you know, it did treat certain of these themes without necessarily explicitly stating them. But I thought there was a sweetness about it and a striving about it. And, you know, I don't want to get into the specific details of it. I thought the ending could have happened about 2 minutes before the actual ending
did.
Oh, man,
I love the ending.
I liked the ending up to a point. And again, I don't want to get into it. I think, without revealing too much, I think it could have ended just when he picked up the glove, as it were.
I think that the actual ending negates the sweetness in a way that I really love. And it turns it into sort of a fatalist romantic film.
Right, because he does, yeah.
He does things we cannot talk about.
He does
well, I explicitly said it in my review. I guess I should have issued a spoiler alert, but I didn't think anybody would fucking care.
Yeah, well, these are hard things to talk about because when we write from Cannes, and as bloggers, we're writing from Cannes in a very immediate sense.
And this movie doesn't have distribution yet.
Yeah,
anyway.
That's the thing. We, you know, and I think this is something that A.O. Scott discussed in one of his dispatches from Cannes, is that you're going into this thing and you're seeing a whole bunch of movies and you're writing about these movies and you're hoping that the movies will eventually get seen by the rest of the people, because even though, you know, where A.O. Scott is coming from is not necessarily a dialogue spot for film, you do want to be able to engage your audience, you know.
Right. You don't want what you're writing to be irrelevant.
Exactly. You want it to be relevant. And I think that I'd like to see the James Gray film get out here and get...
It seems like it would be insane if it didn't. I mean, you think that, like, when Paltrow was a magazine cover girl.
And
yes.
As I recall, Glenn, you were not a fan of the previous James Gray film.
Yeah, I thought We Own the Night had a lot of major problems. And look, I like James Gray. I root for James Gray. I think that you know, his heart is in the right place, although it definitely sometimes puts his head in the wrong place. And I thought that We Own the Night had some really amazing set pieces and some really interesting ideas, and then it just completely went off the rails in the last 20 minutes and became so obvious and so literal. You know, it's one thing to, like, change your ways and enter the police academy. It's another thing to, like, graduate as valedictorian, you know?
Well, more importantly, the villain was named Vadim. So.
That's right, the only reason I had any fondness for that movie whatsoever.
Well, I actually have not liked a single James Gray film until this film. And it's not that I think that he's a bad filmmaker. I tend to not like the way that he handles various issues. But I really liked the way that he handled the idea of romance in this film. I mean, maybe it's just because I tend to be really skeptical about traditional romantic films. But this felt to me like something from the 40s.
Yeah. Well, you know, the guy played by Joaquin Phoenix in the film, he's a damaged guy. He doesn't really have his bearings. And that's made pretty explicit, and that kind of excuses a lot of behavior that he indulges in that would
right.
probably be not excusable in a character who is putatively stable.
Right.
But by coming out and making explicit the fact that he's pretty severely damaged
yeah.
goods right off the bat, it draws you into his kind of sad, striving little world.
The thing is that I think that he actually behaves in the way that, like, a lot of men behave, but it's not the way that men behave in Hollywood movies,
right.
and so they have this idea that he's, like, this suicidal fuck-up to excuse him behaving badly.
I don't think it excuses it, but it certainly lends a poignancy to his character that wouldn't be there without that. It reminds me a little bit, you might remember the old Onion story, you know, man arrested for acting like man in
yeah,
romantic
yeah.
comedy. You know, you know,
here he's got
the damage built in that makes his behavior
right.
somewhat more plausible.
And, you know, and like one of his love interests is kind of like, I want to save you. And the other one is more fucked up than him and kind of needs saving.
Yeah.
And so this was not a well-loved film at Cannes.
Well, the funny...
It had its, like, ardent defenders, but mostly critics were kind of, like, rolling their eyes.
The funny thing is that the French love James Gray. The
yeah,
French
yeah.
were the most ardent defenders of We
That's
Own the Night.
Every film of his gets into Cannes.
And one of the weird things about the press screening of We Own, of Two Lovers was that a combination of poor planning and very, very high demand from the international press caused that press screening to be something of what we in the professional film journalist arena call a clusterfuck, which I think you guys have
and
an
I think
anecdote.
That a lot of people weren't really, a lot of American journalists weren't expecting it.
Indeed, one wasn't entertained for a week about that. That was pretty fucking lame. But here's a question. Was that screen for press or in the...
It was a press screening and it got bifurcated through some weird process that, you know, it was partially shown in one of the smaller houses a half hour after it was scheduled to be shown, and then it was shown in one of the larger houses
a
full hour after it was scheduled to be shown.
I see.
But, I mean, the thing about having a market badge is that you can go to all the films that are just screening in the market, but you can also go to... pretty much every other screening except for premiere screenings, you just have to wait in line. So, but you can't go to press screenings. So press screenings usually happen before premiere happens. And so the press could see like a movie like, well, not Indiana Jones or Chick, but most of the other movies like Two Lovers, they could see that the night before it premieres
right.
to the public. And then I ended up seeing it about half an hour before the public premiere because I went to what's called an overflow screening. Which is what they technically have if the premiere fills up, but it's never really people who are waiting in line for the premiere to go to that. It's usually like press who missed it or people with market badges.
We should explain that the press passes at Cannes are hierarchical. They are determined by the press office at Cannes, and they will issue you according to the circulation or whatever you can convince them. In terms of your legitimacy, press passes of different qualities. The ultimate press pass at Cannes is the white pass.
Badge, which
that
is like
the
Roger Ebert.
Yeah, that is the screw you. I'm getting into this film no matter what pass, and that's the big one.
And
then there's
Pastille
the rose
right
pastille, which is very strange. It's a pink pass with a little yellow dot on it. That's the pastille, and that pass is just slightly below the regular white pass. Then there's the Rose Itself Pass, which is called Priority Press. And then below that is the Blue Pass, and then there's yellow and orange, and they just get worse and worse and worse.
I know that Eric Cohn had a yellow badge this year. I had a market badge, and I had the lowest of the market badges. There's a market badge with a purple stripe, which means you're a buyer, and then there's a market badge with a yellow stripe, which I think means you're an exhibitor, but I never really found out. And then there's everybody else. But I got into every market screening that I tried to go to. The only screening, in fact, that I was shut out of was a overflow screening of a Vicky Cristina Barcelona. I showed up and I left 24 City to go to that. I showed up an hour early and like the theater was already full.
Because that was
like a hot ticket.
And these passes only make sense in the minds of the people handing them out. Because, for example, and I hope I'm not telling tales out of school here, my friend Tom Carson, who's the film and TV critic for GQ, GQ's a huge magazine, he only gets a blue pass every year. I remember the first time I came to Cannes, it was about 4 years ago, and because it was Premiere Magazine, and Premiere Magazine was doing fairly well at the time, everybody from Premiere got a Rose Pastille pass, and I felt very excited about being able to get into the press screenings in a very leisurely fashion. And I noticed that Philip Lope, you know, one of the great film writers of all time, the inventor of the personal essay, I don't need to say much more than he's Philip Lope. I saw that Philip Lope, who's a neighbor and a friendly acquaintance, had a blue pass, and I felt kind of guilty that I'm like waltzing my way into press screenings and Philip Lopate's like waiting online with my friend Tom Carson with a blue pass. The only advantage that came out of it was I was able to introduce Tom and Philip, and they became friendly and we had some nice dinners out there. So the hierarchy is like no other film festival, although I've recently seen that the Toronto Film Festival is putting into place a somewhat similar hierarchy, which I find a little disturbing. I don't know. It's just, I don't know. I think that the press should be free, you know? I mean...
Yeah.
I want to bring up I'm going to butcher a quote that you put on your blog.
Sure.
But that it's impossible to ever pick what will win at Cannes. Because you had a separate idea of what was going to happen.
I don't think that anybody thought that the film that won the Palme d'Or this year was going to win it.
I've tried it for years. I mean, I've only been going to Cannes for 4 years because...
That's surprising to me.
It is surprising. It was kind of a weird thing because for a long time when Anne Thompson was at the magazine, it was in her contract that she go to Cannes. And Cannes,
she's good about contracts.
Yeah, she is. She look, you know, Anne's...
She's a smart fucking lady.
Anne's a friend. Anne's a great... And I love Anne. But, you know, she had it locked in. And Cannes is never... Even when you're doing it on the cheap, Cannes is never a cheap gig. So while she was going, she was the one who was going. So when she actually left the magazine to go to The Hollywood Reporter and freelance, then Peter Herb said to me, like, well, you're the goddamn film critic for the magazine. You should go to Cannes, you know? And that's how I started. But Premiere Magazine... The magazine did not do Cannes on the cheap. We stayed at the Carlton or we stayed at the Martinez. It was an expensive thing. It didn't drain the revenues from the magazine because we had a magazine, you know, business model. It all paid for itself. But, you know, that's why I only started going to Cannes about 5 years ago. But we would always start out, you know, with the opening day competition film, and we'd be like, and we'd look at the jury and we'd say, oh, well, they're going to go for this or they're going to go for that, and we would never be right. I'm never good at this anyway. I can, you know, if you want the exact opposite of what you should pick for an Oscar pool, just look at my Oscar pool. I'm terrible at it. But I've never been able to second guess a Cannes jury, and my feeling this year was that the Cannes jury was going to go for socially conscious films.
Right. Well, that's what
which they
said.
Did.
Yeah.
But
what happened?
Just not the ones
Kentucky
that I thought.
Laura always seemed like a second-tier filmmaker to me. I actually like two of his movies a great deal, but I'm sold.
That film screened at the very end of the festival.
Yes.
Most press didn't even see it. I didn't see it.
And he's not, I mean...
It was the Rosetta Syndrome.
But people who did see it really liked it. And, you know, I mean, there were basically two predictions for the Palme d'Or, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But people who liked Che thought that Che was going to get it, and people who didn't like Che thought that Waltz with Bashir was going to get it.
Yeah, I didn't think Che was going to get it. I thought Waltz with Bashir was going to get it. And
so,
I like Che very much.
But I agree with... I don't remember who wrote it. I read it somewhere on the internet, but somebody said something like, it would be too obvious for Sean Penn's jury to pick Che. So he would want to, you know, pick something a little bit more obscure than that. So I was thinking that they were going to pick Walter Bashir. Yeah. But I also understood that if so many people thought that they were going to pick that film, it was probably wrong. But I never thought they were going to pick The Class.
Yeah. The significance of France honoring an Israeli film would have been pretty cataclysmic, by the way.
Right.
And maybe that's one reason why they didn't. But I didn't think they were going to go for Che because Che is not... For everything that it is not a rousing film. It's not a film that makes you come out of the theaters and go, yeah, long live the world revolution. It's much more detached and dispassionate than that. And that's why someone, you know, Sean Penn came out in a press conference early on and said, we want to remind, or we want to teach film, you remember that. We want to teach filmmakers that they need to be conscious of the world that they're living in. Which I had a lot of fun with. Because
I mean,
just
the
like,
idea of Sean Penn teaching anybody anything is pretty problematic.
I still have the whole The Weight of Water, which I actually saw, where he plays a poet who keeps his sunglasses on the whole time. It's like the worst thing ever.
And wasn't he on a boat with Elizabeth Hurley?
Yes,
the highlight of the movie is Elizabeth Hurley, like, stimulating her nipple with an ice cube. Like, it's actually downhill from there. I feel bad because
That would be the highlight of any
films.
Number of
I can't
films, actually.
The name of that.
Elizabeth Hurley stimulating her nipple with an ice cube could liven up any number of films.
That
should just be like a flash frame in most
films. It was that last movie of that woman who was in Mike Lee movies, and I can't remember her name, but it was her last film. It was just
Caitlin.
Catherine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was just like, oh god, what happened?
It's like that. Did you
read? They actually have come out the same time as K-19, The Widowmaker. Also,
yeah.
Did you read Zero?
From the same school I
did you read
from.
Zeroville, the Steve Erickson novel?
Yeah, I love that book.
The flash frame in that. It's not the person.
I actually read that book while I was at Sundance this year, and that book was more engaging intellectually or emotionally than any film I saw at Sundance.
I'm actually working on a filmography of that book for the blog. It's going to take me a while.
I love that book. I interviewed Steve on one of our podcasts.
So could you guys talk about your process of writing there at Ken? Like,
how did you
find the time? Where did you go? Did you go in
and
corners?
Can I do this first?
You go for it.
All right. Well, my housing situation at Ken was very bad. And it was basically, I decided to go to Cannes like 2 weeks before the festival, and that's why I didn't even apply for a press pass. It came together really last minute because some friends of mine had a place and they had an extra bed. It wasn't until I got to France that I found out that the place that it was a 30-minute bus ride away from the Croisette, and that the extra bed was a mat on the floor of the kitchen. And that there was one key for the place for four people. So we all had to meet up every night to go home together, and I ended up usually going to bed around 4 and getting up around 7 or 8 to you know, go to a movie. And I also, we didn't have any Wi-Fi in the place, like no internet at all. So basically what I would do is I'd go to an early morning screening and sleep through it. Then I would go to a 10 a.m. screening and sleep through it. And then it would be around 1 o'clock, and I'd be like, fuck, I'm a shitty film critic. And I'd go to this room on the fourth floor of the play called Lake Club, and which had this huge balcony that overlooked where celebrities get out of their cars before they get on the red carpet. Like, where they get out of their cars, and there's, like smart paparazzi stand there. So the first day that I went there to write was when the Indiana Jones premiere was happening. And I just, like, sat down, plugged my computer in, was, like, finally getting ready to write, and I hear, like, you know, heart-curdling screams coming from the ground. Go outside and try to figure out what's happening. End up doing a blog post about that. But that's pretty much what it was like. It was like I was sleeping through a lot of movies that I wish I hadn't slept through, but writing about the movies that I could write about, like, sitting in that room, because having a market pass, I didn't have access to the press lounge.
So you couldn't go home and work, you had to work like...
No, I certainly couldn't go home and work because not only was it too far, but there wasn't any internet.
No internet.
So usually my day would involve getting up at 7, being at the play by 8, seeing 4 movies a day usually, writing in between movies, meeting friends for dinner or drinks around 7 or 8, maybe going to a 10 o'clock movie or maybe just like hanging out after that. And then getting home really late at night and on 3 hours of sleep, starting over again.
Well, your tale of woe totally beats mine, definitely.
I don't think mine's a tale of woe. I still feel like I'm really fucking lucky to have been there. But I also feel like at least for the first 4 or 5 days of the festival, I wasn't doing optimal work. I think that I got better at it as it went along.
I mean, Glenn, did you go as a representative of
Well, that's the thing. I, you know, it was a weird thing because... Premier had paid for my plane ticket, and in the negotiations after I was terminated, they said, "Oh well, we won't make you reimburse the plane ticket." This is for this is on May 8th. I was scheduled to leave for Canada on May 12th. We won't let you. We won't make you reimburse your plane ticket, and we won't try and get your press pass taken away. I think that was less an act of charity than just an act of sort of like, we don't know who to call in France to fuck you. So they said that was the condition. And so, you know, I paid for my own place. I took on a roommate because that would help. But again, the place where I was staying had no Wi-Fi. In past years, I would stay at a place like the Martinez or the Carlton that had Wi-Fi, and it would just be really, I would be able to blog every movie I saw because I could just walk back to my hotel room, open the computer, and just do it. Here I had to like concentrate my efforts by going to the Wi-Fi lounge, which is very nicely supplied by the French telecommunications company Orange. But it's very crowded. On the most crowded days, a friend of ours, described it as looking like a Civil War hospital with laptops.
Who said that?
It was James. It was a very good. Very good metaphor, simile.
He's so good at saying
he's
things.
Very good at, he's very,
10 words or less.
Very pithy. So what I decided to do, rather than blog on individual films, I would just do a sort of mass thing where I'd do 4 films at once or so on. And then, of course, I realized, like, well, you know, I'm not getting paid for this. You know, it's like, I established my blog, Some Came Running, immediately in the wake of my termination at Premiere, because I had built up a fairly substantial and incredibly cool audience at my blog at Premiere, and I didn't want to like just sort of drop them.
But you also had a few things.
I had,
a
few things. I did something for. I did a couple of things for
IndieWire.
So you know, I picked up. Yeah, I picked up, and I did a nice, fun thing with Matt Singer at IFC for the CanCam.
Yeah.
So you know, it was just a way of when I got. When I got terminated at Premiere, I kind of like had a choice of just sort of crawling into a hole and being kind of miserable. And I talked about it with my wife, and I thought, well, you know what? Just get back on the goddamn horse, and you're gonna do this. This is what you are now. Go out and do it. And I'm glad I did. I had a lot of fun, but it was a weird adjustment to make, because it's sort of like, do I have to? You know, I want to work, and I want to bring my readers good assessments of what I'm doing. But by the same token, it's like, do I have to necessarily work as hard as I might? You know, it's a weird.
Was there any badge ridness once you got there?
No, I got love. No,
here?
I actually had a Rose Pass. I had a Rose Badge, which is one step below the Rose Pass deal.
Somebody went everyone every year and said that, you know, if you skip a year, then they just screw you on.
Well,
your
no,
badge
well that's status. that's the reason. That's another reason I went. I just wanted to go out. I don't know what's going to happen next year, but we'll see. But when I went, no, you know, I don't. I was actually very paranoid going up there. Like, what if they said, well, we just heard that you got terminated. You know, they don't follow it that closely. And the deal that happened with the Premiere people was like, okay, you can have the credentials that say Premiere, but don't represent yourself as being
like
from Premiere.
Would.
Yeah. Well, this is corporate for you. But I didn't get any weirdness. In fact, I got love bombed. And for the first 5 days, I don't think I paid for a meal. Then after that, I was like, oh, yeah, you're here.
You've been here for
yeah.
5 days.
Yeah,
it's
like
a photograph taken every 2 days.
Yeah, that's like pony up, you know, motherfucker. It's,
well, I'm kind of curious about that. When did you guys find out what passes you were getting? I mean, I'm sure, Karina, you found out like very.
I didn't. I mean, I had no idea what anything was about. Honestly, like, I was so confused about Cannes that once I had like a 5-hour layover in Paris, and once I finally made it to the city, I had no idea where I was staying. My cell phone wasn't working, which was unexpected to me. And so I had no idea how to get in touch with the people I was staying with. So I just got off the bus, and I walked into the play, and I basically started crying. And I, like, stood by the elevator crying until Eric Cohn walked by. And I was like, Eric! Eric! And he was like, I totally understand why you're crying. I cried, too, my first can.
I've done that before with Eric, but still for different reasons.
It's hard to be an adult in these situations.
Yeah. I mean, I had never been to Europe before. I got a passport for the first time to go to Toronto last year. So I was totally out of my element, and I kept like asking people in the play after being in Cannes for 5 minutes, you know, where can I go to get Wi-Fi? And everybody was giving me different answers in broken English, and it was totally difficult for me. And I was the worst example of a shitty, ugly American. But I couldn't help myself. You know, I don't speak French.
It's anxiety producing. I mean, it took me 4 days of being there this time because. To go out there on your own, I mean, you know, I had been out there last year for Premiere.com with a couple of colleagues, and those same colleagues were there this year, but I wasn't working with them anymore. So, just the anxiety of being on your own, as you were, Karina, it can be galvanizing and depressing. And it took me about 4 days of being in the festival to just not have a fucking knot in the pit of my stomach and start to enjoy myself.
Honestly, like, Eric, once I found him, he, like, took me directly to the IndieWire offices, and I know everybody at IndieWire, and that, you know, I was just able to put my stuff down and, like, plug my computer in and sort of, like, figure my shit out, and that, you know, like, I think the big thing about going to a festival like Cannes, which is really overwhelming, especially to somebody who's, you know, ridiculously American and doesn't speak French, is that once you, if you can really get in with people you know who have been there before, it helps a lot.
One of the hilarious things about Cannes is that people, when you talk about going to Cannes, people talk to you and react as if it's a paid vacation.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Which is hilarious. I mean,
even if you do, you know, drink every night or whatever it is, like, you're still working so hard that you wish you weren't drinking every night.
It's working in your head, I think.
No, the mind stuff never stops.
Yeah.
There's a place in the Palais that when the Lumiere empties out at 8:30 in the morning, there's a place in the Palais where all the critics' mailboxes are, all the press mailboxes are, and then all these little factions getting together and debating and arguing.
Arguing never stops.
You know, a couple of years ago when Queen Elizabeth was there, the Sofia Coppola film, it was practically fistfights out there, but it never stops. And I mean, I joked about this on my blog. I said, pardon me?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. Jesus. What did I call it?
Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the Cate Blanchett film that was at Toronto.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Last year.
Yeah. Yeah. No fist fights over that.
I saw that at 9 in the morning.
No, the movie itself is a fist fight. The play's going.
I joked about it on the blog at one point. I said, even my therapist is like, oh, well, it's a perk. It's like, no, it's not a perk. It's part of the job.
And nobody gets it unless they're there.
Right.
I mean, honestly, actually, the IndieWire guys, like, always, like, take a day off and they go to, you know, Antibes or whatever. But I don't have that luxury.
Oh, I never did that.
Actually being there for 12 days and working every day, it is this sort of torture where you know that you're in, like, this beautiful place and that there are rich people who are just there eating oysters or whatever the fuck they're doing, but you're working and you're dead tired. And
one of my best friends, a very well-off man of the world, gave me a list the first time I went to Cannes of all the places I needed to go around there, you know, the Matisse Chapel.
Yeah, and when are you going to fucking have
Juan Le Pen? It's like never going to happen, ever.
Like, if you're lucky, you get to, you know, not eat a meal that is a baguette.
Yeah.
I hate to say at this point, I have to invoke the No Murray stop clock, a great addition to the podcast.
You know, I'm very curious as to how you guys got your traditions on this podcast. Like, where did that come from?
Drinking.
But, succinct, huh?
That said, we are now, for the first time, actually second time ever, taking a brief intermission as one part of the team flies away to L.A.
The speaking part.
Well, the speaking part goes to have a shitty overpriced dinner.
Yes.
And I can say that.
Where are you having your shitty overpriced dinner?
A good friend of mine is leaving for L.A. for good, so I'm off to have a cash-only dinner.
What's the name?
That's it, no more stop clock, and here's your fun intermission music.